John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Sarah Ferguson hosts Four Corners on ABC TV, but she also was the creator of The Killing Season, the special ABC program about the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd feud and how it unwound. There's a book she's just written, which is the behind-the-scenes story, drawing on the what was broadcast, but also a lot of the stuff that hit the cutting room floor, and she will be our first guest on The Conversation Hour, joining me in just a moment. My co-host could not be better credentialed. Fran Bailey is the former minister in the Howard government who was in charge of small business and tourism and other things, now gainfully employed in her retirement with a new gig she just told me about as we were about to turn the microphones on. Fran Bailey, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Good to see you here. And as we approach the 20th anniversary of what John Howard proudly calls his most significant reform of gun reform after the Port Arthur massacre,
yes,
you just told me a second ago that you have a new ambassadorship.
I have, John. I've agreed to be an ambassador for the Cascades Female Factory, which was where the female convicts were sent when they arrived in Van Diemen's Land. In fact, I went out on the harbour just to see the view that they would have as they came off the ships. Terribly foreboding. And then, of course, they had to walk from there, which is a long way from Hobart. It's over an hour's drive in a car. And they walked all that way. It was called the Walk of Shame. And these were women who had done nothing more in many cases than to steal a handkerchief or to steal some food to feed their children. Incredible stories. So the site has become listed as a World Heritage Site, and it's part of the Port Arthur Trust.
Part of the complex.
Well, part of the authority, the authority that runs Port Arthur now runs the Cascades Female Factory as well. And it's, I mean, it's in a state of ruin. And so they want to raise some money to repair some of the walls and some of the relics that still remain, but to essentially build an interpretive centre, but to also link it to ongoing research about the role that these women played in developing Australia. We virtually know nothing. In fact, I've been doing a test and I've been asking friends, what role do you think that female convicts played in the heritage of our country? And I've had these bemused looks with people saying, but weren't they all prostitutes?
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, they weren't. And not a large percentage, but there certainly was a percentage who could read and write and who went on to work on in farms and, well, the beginnings of some of the sheep stations down in Tassie and also on the mainland.
Well, building a whole society. And, of course, the ticket of leave, they became free settlers and off they went from there. But 20 years ago, were you a backbencher or a minister when Port Arthur, when the massacre happened?
I was a backbencher.
In the Howard government?
Yes, I was.
And what impact did the Port Arthur massacre have then on you and your future?
Well, I think like every Australian, just, you know, shocked to the core. I did have a number of constituents actually who were there on that day, and listening to them, that brought it home to me. But interestingly, John Howard asked me to go, this was in Canberra, to go out and address this enormous rally. I certainly had never spoken in front of so many people in my life. I had to climb up on the back of a truck. And actually,
a rally of whom?
A rally of people who had come to both protest against the proposed gun legislation, but also, thankfully, many who were in support of it. I was personally very strongly in support of it, and I think John chose me because I had this very large rural electorate, and, you know, there were going to be, I had to make the case why a number of these people were very, very upset that they had to give up their guns.
Yep.
Oh, it was, I mean,
we should not forget how vigorously debated this particular issue was.
Look, I had people, they call themselves deer hunters.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you don't get a barrage of calls from the story that I'm about to tell you.
I have some friends who are deer hunters.
And some of them...
I'm very grateful when they give me a piece of venison.
Right. Well, I had some people come to my office to say to me that, you know, how upset that they were. One of them spat at me, which gave me a bit of an indication of obviously how deeply he felt about all of this. But when I asked them the sort of guns that they use, these were semi-automatic guns. And I said, well, you call yourself a sporting shooter. What chance does the deer have in all of this? This was just slaughter of deers. This wasn't hunting and then killing a deer. This was just out-and-out slaughter of
deers. Well, a lot of people are, let's be blunt, they're gun enthusiasts. They love their guns.
And many are very, very responsible.
Plenty of them.
Yeah. But there are some who aren't. And also, there are far too many guns in our society.
Again.
Still, yes, because there's illegal guns are being imported back into the country.
Handguns apparently are readily available if you know who to ask and how much to pay.
Well, I'm sure that's the case. So I think we need to be really vigilant again, because I think a lot of the good work that John Howard did has probably been eroded over the years.
Is it? I mean, it is one of the signature reforms that he introduced, along with the GST, which of course transformed the economy. But the gun reforms. Certainly...
I was very involved in the GST too.
Yeah, you had your hands full, didn't you? Oh dear! Federal election—it's all but—it's all but on now with the budget coming.
It's going to be a very long election, isn't it?
And Scott Morrison's got his work cut out for him, because if indeed all the options he's floated in the last few months have been shot down by his own backbench, hasn't got a lot of room to manoeuvre anymore.
Well, I think there's been so much anticipation now building about the budget that it's going to have to be a very responsible budget, and one that is going to set the tone for future development. I think he's got enormous weight on his shoulders.
Whether or not it, in fact, rescues the economy, quite apart from Mr. Turnbull's electoral fortunes, there's a lot hanging on it. It's an enormous responsibility for a first-time treasurer.
Yeah, I think it's an enormously difficult task for anyone in that position to be able to get a balanced view out there. I mean, anyone who believes that one budget is always going to be a quick fix are just kidding themselves. The budget is designed to put the development for the economy and how it will develop into the future.
We will see. And the submarines announcement due pretty much any time. And all the tips, certainly on Twitter, everyone's saying that they believe that it's the French that have prevailed over the Germans and the Japanese.
Sounds like it.
Which, if you were a defence bureaucrat and you had to choose whether you wanted to go and do your training and negotiations in Japan or Germany or maybe somewhere in Paris or rural France, what do you reckon? I'm sure that would never influence
I'm sure
them.
That there were, they weren't the primary considerations, John.
Well, there you go. Fran Bailey, former Liberal Member of Parliament for McEwen for a long time and a minister in the Howard government, is my co-host. Our first guest, Sarah Ferguson, has emerged from immersing herself in the minutiae of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd prime ministerships. She made The Killing Season a hit on ABC TV. She's followed up now with a book which tells you the inside story. Some of the material that hit the cutting room floor, as well as her personal insights and observations as she went about recording the various interviews that made for such gripping television. Sarah, welcome to the conversation.
Very nice to be
and
here.
Congratulations. And the book is like the TV series. You just can't stop. You can't turn away. You can't put it down, because every page tells you something else that makes you go, oh my God, you're kidding. They didn't really do that. Was that your intention? Is that what you set out to do?
I think it's the quality of the material. That's why the series itself was so good, that it's so dramatic, and we always wanted to tell it as a drama rather than as a documentary. So we stole every technique we could find from drama. And when I sat down to write it, I'm sure all writers say this, and I'm just a beginner, but it drove itself along at the same pace, that is, wanting to leave you with a cliffhanger at the end of the chapter so that you go on to the next one. That is the nature of this material. It's human drama at its most intense.
And I I kind of, every now and again, when you're watching the TV series and reading the book, you sort of wanted to reach out to the people being interviewed and to say to them, don't!
Well, that's
why did you agree to this, you idiot?
I never had that thought. I couldn't allow that thought to infect my mind in case I suddenly became all soft and gooey and sympathetic. But I did have that sense, particularly the first time I met Julia Gillard, which is when she went down the path of Kevin Rudd had a mental problem, that I wanted to effectively, I wanted to lean over and tap her on the arm in a sort of friendly fashion and say, don't go there, don't do that. You're going to undermine your case if you do that. I did manage to stop myself, and I think she would have looked at me as if I was crazy had I sat there and offered her advice. It was certainly not the right thing to do, but still, there were many times when I thought, if you could see me, I'm putting my hands over my eyes, don't do it, don't do it.
It had overtures of an authentic Greek tragedy. I mean, just the fact that the two of them, when they were leader and deputy leader in opposition, appeared to work so well together, and certainly in the early stages of the Rudd government, and for it to, you know, just disentangle so quickly, it was breathtaking, and the fact that they really, you know, don't like each other at all. They don't trust each other. And you wonder if as individuals, they're ever going to be able to get over that.
Now, they both claim that they've moved on, and this was the phrase I came to dislike and distrust the most. Mm. I don't want to be in your series because I've moved on. We don't need to talk about this because we've moved on, which I thought was quite wrong on the part of the party, that they can't choose to say that they've moved on when the electorate, clearly the voters, were still deeply uncertain and puzzled about what had happened. And I think that's part of the draw of the series, is these two great characters cut off in their prime, and we didn't ever really understand exactly what had happened because they did such a bad job of telling us. But this idea that either of them could move on. Now, of course, they'll go on to do other things, but just imagine...
Like run the United Nations.
Run the United Nations, for example. If you spent your whole life relentlessly and carefully building towards this one great
every
ambition...
Every stepping stone.
Every stepping stone for both of them, and that both of them were cut each other off at the knees, that there is something unfinished that must remain unfinished. Although the wounds may heal, the sharp edges may get rounded by time, that sense of what was lost can never depart, I think.
In fact, you make a point, and you quote Anthony Albanese. He was really, it seems as if he was the only one who really understood, because at one stage you quote him as saying, you're going to kill two prime ministers if you go ahead with this.
He is, on the night and on the days surrounding those events in June in 2010, he does look like the conscience of the party. I don't want to overblow the language too much, but Paul Howe said that what had happened to the rest of them was that they got trapped in the echo chamber of the Labour movement. And Paul has a colourful turn of phrase, the former head of the Australian Workers' Union. Trapped in the echo chamber, and that they lost touch with the voters. And what Anthony Albanese did was always to be looking out towards the voters. You know how some see in some nations that with a coast, some of the people turn their back on the sea. They don't become fishermen and swimmers. They turn their back on the ocean. I think the Labour Party turned its back on the public, but Albanese didn't. He kept that connection with the voters, and that's why he was able, unlike almost anyone else, to see it on the night that the voters would respond in shock and horror.
And you tell us, as much as anything, you blame Karl Marx. And now we have to explain the gag.
Yes, so Karl Bittar and Mark Arbib were the two doyens of the New South Wales Labour Party from Sussex Street, that great beating black heart of New South Wales Labour.
But very junior members of the government.
Oh, well, this is the, you know, Fran, you make such an important point, and it's one of the most salient features of that government, that all of the plotters, while experienced in state politics, were all new to federal politics. Only one of them who outed himself as playing a role on the day, Tony Burke, who placed himself right bang at the centre of the drama for reasons that have always slightly escaped me, when he didn't need to. Anyway, he was the only one who had come of the plotters, of the instigators, who had come into Parliament in the previous election. All of the rest of them had been in Parliament for less than 3 years.
But they had a long history of agitation and activism within the factions, and Karl Marx, Karl Bittar, and Mark Arbib, and it needs to be said, both of whom now work for
Crown Casino, and in one
for
of
James
the,
Packer,
one of the most theatrical lines. When Kevin Rudd is at his best, he can be, his language can be dreadful when he's at his worst, but when he's at his best, he has a quality of a pastor or P.T. Barnum about him, and he leant over and he's described Mark Abib leaving politics. There goes the heart and soul. There goes Mark Abib off to the heart and soul of New South Wales Labour, the casino empire, and then took a long Kevin Rudd pause and said, was that too harsh? But there they are, and that's where we found them. And so our first attempts to get them to take part were all off to the sort of faux plushness of the Crown Empire in Sydney.
And so there they are, still scheming and plotting and pretending that they have moved on, and in fact they haven't. And the bizarre thing is not just how junior they are, but how nervous they are at every, and I think Rudd at one stage says focus groups, schmocus groups, but these guys live and breathe by every opinion poll, every focus group, and they end up jumping at shadows.
That's right. And if you talk to the pollsters, they'll tell you that what was so unusual when Carl Bitar took over the job as the Secretary of New South Wales Labor, that he and Mark Abib would come to focus groups, certainly Carl would. So instead of letting the company run the focus group and gather its material, they would come to the focus group. Carl Bitar would then call Mark Abib, and Mark Abib would give him a question to put into the focus group during the discussions. Now, one of the moments where this was at its most acute was Kevin Rudd is in Copenhagen. So after all the attempts to get a comprehensive global agreement at Copenhagen are coming to an end on the final days, far away in the Sydney suburb of Hurstville, Mark Abib and Carl Bitar and Bruce Hawker are watching a focus group. And at the end of the focus group, they call Kevin Rudd in Copenhagen, and just imagine the dislocation. And they tell him, people don't like the emissions trading scheme, the CPRS, you've got to drop it. That's the advice that's going to Kevin Rudd as he sort of walks off the stage with Ban Ki-moon. As Lachlan Harris observed, of all the decisions that were made, the former press secretary, you know, who gave a very thoughtful interview, I have to say, very reflective about the failures of the structures within Labor that caused all of these problems, that you can't make decisions of this magnitude based on focus groups, but they did.
Okay, well, let's step back, and Fran, I want to just change the focus a bit, and how eerie it is that just the other day we had Nikki Saver in here going through in detail her book, which documents in agonising detail a replication of the dysfunction of the Rudd-Gillard years with Tony Abbott. So here is the incredibly effective opposition leader who tore down Rudd and Gillard, who himself was eaten alive by his own party after only 18 months in office. So is there some disease that's infected both of our political parties and which is infecting Australian politics?
I think it is. When it happened to Kevin Rudd, I think we all thought that it was a once in a generation event, an anomaly. I think very few people thought this is something that could be reproduced. It was so disastrous for Labor. The consequences were so dramatic, the aftershocks so grave, so disruptive, that I don't think anybody thought anybody would be crazy enough to start it again. Now, of course, or to repeat it, of course the dynamics are somewhat different, but I don't think there's any doubt that that disruption caused in Labor has been passed to the Liberal Party, notwithstanding the difference in popularity of Tony Abbott versus Kevin Rudd and all that shows up. I think it is part of the same pattern. And that's what the pollsters are seeing too, that the country hasn't recovered from the removal of Kevin Rudd. We're in the same wave.
So if there's something else, what is it, Fran?
Well, I think that there's another element to this too. And I think our next guest in talking about his book actually segues really into this topic, because both Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott made promises that they broke, and that trust was broken with the Australian public.
I've got a
and
different
I'm not
theory.
Sure that either of them were ever recovered from that.
Okay, I think that's a symptom. The disease is actually something else. I think what's happened is that the world has changed and politics hasn't changed with it. So the way the world works with the digitisation of our economy and in particular communication has meant things happen much faster, and politics hasn't adapted. And they're still stuck in a mindset, kind of a print era mindset for a digital communication era. So you've got these guys, they haven't adapted to how rapidly the way of communicating a message. I mean, they've picked up the tricks, social media, and they've learned how to use Twitter and Facebook and how to launch a campaign and deal with GetUp and all of that sort of stuff. But that's very superficial. It's a veneer. The fundamental issue of relationship building and maintaining and selling an idea, they're still adapting to it. How's that for a theory?
Oh, I don't agree with that, John. I think that that has been intrinsically important in politics from day one. If you're an elected member of parliament and you want to bring about change, you've got to make your case for change, and you've got to establish a trusting relationship with people in order to bring about that change. And I think that I really do believe that that's what has changed. You go back, it was Sam, I think, who was making a point in his book. Go back to Hawke and Keating, Howard and Costello. They introduced really difficult reform.
Yeah.
But they made the case for it, and they actually, the general population trusted them. They mightn't have liked it, but they knew that they were reliable. They knew that they were competent, and there was an openness about what they were doing. I think that's one of the things that we've lost, that openness.
One of the things that we listened to was Alan Milburn, who was a British MP who was part of Tony Blair's government and a communications expert, part of Talk About Black Hearts, the Black Heart of British Labour under Tony Blair that became the great series The Thick of It. But anyway, Alan Milburn is a proficient operator. He came here and he said the problem was that by 2010, by the time of the 2010 election, the public, not just from what happened to Kevin Rudd, but also in state elections around the country, had the impression that Labour was about power for its own sake, that this was power without purpose.
And I
think that part of what you're talking about, that speed and fast reaction, works against it, that they, by the daily victories, and we know there was this huge emphasis on winning the daily cycle, that emphasis on daily victories did mean that some of the understanding of the broad arc of persuasion had been lost.
But you can't pretend to be one thing and then actually be another. And this is where Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn have got it all over. So David Cameron, I'll predict to you now, he will never recover from the Panama Papers disclosures. You can't say you're clamping down on international tax avoidance on the one hand and then have to admit that you're the beneficiary of it on the other. You just can't. You are mortally wounded, full stop. And this is where whatever Donald Trump's, sort of erratic ideas might be, what you see is what you get, and people love that in a politician.
So
isn't this one of the big problems with, and this is the question about whether Labour has learnt this, that one of the issues for them when they rolled their leader was that they had no explanation ready. They had nothing to say.
No.
They had no narrative for the public. In fact,
Julia Gillard said it was a government had lost its way.
And, the night before...
And she was central to that government.
Let me tell you, the night before, on the night that she spent the long night in the orange chairs with Kevin Rudd that ended up in her deciding to challenge, she went into Wayne Swan's office, where a number of senior members of the cabinet were gathered, and tested the line. What do you think about a good government's lost its way? I'm thinking this is the line for the next day. And Jenny Macklin said, no, don't do that. That's completely daft. You can't use that line because it means we can't campaign on what we've done. Don't do that. The next day, Julia Gillard gets up and says a good government's lost its way. And everybody knew that line was empty. Now, Bob Carr would say there is no line to describe a scene like the end of Titus Andronicus with dead bodies everywhere and people being baked in a pie, that there is no line. And he says that was the party's mistake for flinging Julia Gillard in at this impossible time. But that inability to describe why this change was necessary was fundamental to its failure. And the question about Turnbull then, all the questions around him, he made a good case on the day that he stood in the parliamentary courtyard. But I think people are now have much less patience. If you're going to unseat a first-term prime minister, your decisions better show that upheaval is worthwhile or you'll be punished.
A companion piece,
Bill Shorten's role at the next election. Is he going? Do you think that he's going to be damaged? Because, I mean, he was obviously part of pulling Kevin Rudd down and, the famous stand-up interview that he did only, you know, half an hour or something before they went in to have a ballot about Julia Gillard's
leadership. In 2013. Now, Kevin Rudd claims that Bill Shorten said to him in 2013 that it was a dumb idea in 2010. But what Bill Shorten has done is to keep the archive clean, and this is why we spent such a lot of time trying to get him to appear in this series, because he has this...
cleverly refused.
Yes, that's right. But yes.
Public doesn't forget.
I think they're banking on the public forgetting, and because there are no images and because there's very little material on the record, it doesn't get replayed and replayed.
But instead, you'll be told, here is the architect of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Here is the policy wonk. Here is the Beaconsfield bill.
We've moved on.
And they'll bury Bill with the chopsticks. Text messages galore, and it's fascinating. People are joining in. Justin Trudeau in Canada, the new leader there, is successful. He's the leader for the 21st century and very transparent. And so far, that has worked. But you have to be so much more consistent. And several people saying it's because there's so much more scrutiny. There is so much more. The 24-hour media cycle and the minutiae of it all, you can't get away with anything like you used to in the old days. So Sophie Mirabella can just in a kind of self-important way exaggerate her influence by telling the people at a public meeting you could have had a $10 million hospital, and then the next 3 days they've got to hose it down. I mean, at least Fran up in Indi, the Liberal Party won't be spending a lot of money on Sophie Mirabella's campaign anymore, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, I have nothing to do with it, John. I don't know.
It's a very economical move for her to make a slip up before the campaign even begins. We will see what happens there. Sarah, congratulations.
Thank you.
A companion piece to the now available DVDs of The Killing Season. The Killing Season Uncut is Sarah Ferguson's print version, and it gives you all her personal insights and some of the stuff that never made it to air, as well as some of her observations of the major players as they make their way through. Sarah Ferguson's The Killing Season Uncut, published by Melbourne University Press. Our next guest, Sam Crosby, used to work in the role of being a political advisor. He's now an academic, and he's written a book where he says that politicians never recover from telling a big lie, whether it's in Europe, in America, or here in Australia, with all sorts of case studies. Good morning to you, Sam. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks for having us.
Which clearly Fran Bailey has connected with very, very firmly indeed. You've got examples from all over the English-speaking world, I'll say,
sure,
of politicians who break the bond of trust. But surely politicians know if you lie to the public these days, you'll get found out.
You know, that was the reason I actually wrote this book, because I thought you were right. You know, and we saw Tony Abbott that had attacked Julie Gillard so successfully, so comprehensively through a frame of trust. You know, everything came back to she lied, she lied, she lied. And then at the first opportunity, his first budget, he and Joe Hockey got up there and almost sort of went out of their way to break every single promise that they made during the election.
No cuts to health, no cuts to education,
right.
The SBS and the ABC. Yeah.
And so it's just not getting through, I think. But one of the points I want to bring out in the book is it's not just about breaking promises. That's obviously a key part of it. But I think what John Howard showed in 2004, when the Labor Party had been hitting him relentlessly, you know, relentlessly over children overboard scandal, he stood up and he said, and without any reference to a polling sample or a focus group, went for a walk in the gardens of the lodge and realised, you know what, people trust me to do what I say I'm going to do. They trust my record. And he was one of the most, if not the most consistent politician, you know, for the better part of 30 years in Australia's history. And so stood up there and gave that sort of jaw-droppingly brazen statement about this is an election about trust. And, you know, Latham says he nearly fell off a chair. You know, the advisor in the Labor office was sitting around going, what the hell, you know. But he got that trust isn't just about honesty. It's about consistency. You know, that's a big part of it. It's about honesty. It's about personal openness. And all of these things sort of combine.
Do you think that he could get away with that now? Do you think you could make that switch now? You think about how much Gillard was punished over the carbon tax. Do you think that times have changed and that it wouldn't work now?
I'm just going to do to Sarah what Sarah did to everybody else. As she asked that question, ladies and gentlemen, she with her right hand reached across towards Sam and nearly touched him on the arm as she reached across to introduce a very compassionate approach to the grilling that she's now getting.
Look, I think you could.
I'm blushing for the first time in my professional life.
Can we make a promo out of that? Sorry, Sam.
And I was going to try and ask a question too.
Look, I think you could. I think you could. One of the things I go through with the Julie Gillard example in the book is we look at how that strategy came about and how it unfolded. And this is going to sound completely absurd, but everyone I've spoken to has backed this up. No one remembered her standing up on the banks of the Brisbane River on election, or the couple of weeks before election, and giving that promise. The next line out of her mouth was, "We will have a carbon pricing scheme, blah, blah, blah." And the advisor at the time says, "We just couldn't remember." Greg Combe says, I didn't even see it happen. You know, it didn't get replayed. Insignificant.
Well, he
that's
was
right.
in hospital.
Having a minor operation, that's right.
But when it came to making the decision to acknowledge it at the time, that's when things got different. That's when people's advice came in to say, don't acknowledge that it's a carbon tax. Why did she not understand that she had to follow that advice?
So we're all victims of circumstance. She was coming off the back of, I don't know if you recall, but there was a budget where we were going into debt. And Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan didn't want to say billions or millions. Oh, sorry, didn't want to say billions, the billion word. So they were talking about thousands of millions. And it was just absurd. You know, everyone knew what a thousand million was. And we were unforgiving of our condemnation of them. And she'd come through that and said, we can't have this nonsense semantic game. And in any normal political environment, I'd say, you know what, that's probably an okay strategy. Don't have this semantic game. Talk about how this is going to affect, you know, the punters' lives. What she didn't bank on was this incredibly focused attack from Tony Abbott, who just day after day after day just kept going up. And the rest is history.
What about the role of the media? Sarah is constantly invited by Julia Gillard, no less, to explore in greater detail the role of the media in her demise, but also the disease that's affecting Australian politics. What's your view of the role of the media in this relentless 24-hour news cycle?
Look, I think it's super easy to blame the media in this. I think what the problem is politicians reacting badly to the 24-hour news cycle, and they sort of fall over themselves to give these clever grabs rather than just having, as Fran was saying earlier, just an open, honest conversation about here's what I'm trying to do. I think that's what, frankly, we all like to see when Malcolm Turnbull came into the role.
Sam, this is one of the elements of trust that I think is often missing, and that's a connectedness with whichever group it is that you're dealing with. So that if you're the Prime Minister, you've got to connect with the nation. If you're the local MP, you connect with your electorate. If you're missing connecting with whoever that your audience is, there can't be trust.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's just not that rapport there.
And you're right, and I think that's what Bill Shorten's problem was when he was getting lampooned for all those zingers. You know, he had the line worked out, someone had given him the line, he was coming on, he was sort of stumbling over them, and, you know, Keating's zingers were great, but they came to him, you know, he was on his feet and he would deliver them, he could get away with it.
I'm sure some of them came to him the night before. He's brilliant, but no one's that brilliant. Yeah.
Possibly, but, you know, the point is that you need to just have an open, honest conversation and tell people what you're going to do. Don't stuff them around.
So it's about authenticity. And this is going back to this theory, which is mine. I'm sounding like a Monty Python script now. But the trouble with the 24-hour media cycle and the scrutiny of social media and everyone being a publisher through Twitter or whatever it might be is that authenticity is just unfakeable. It used to be you could fake authenticity as a politician. I don't think you can anymore. As soon as you contradict yourself or a bit of hypocrisy comes through, someone's going to be onto it. It's not just a half a dozen people working up in a newspaper office or 20 people in the press gallery in Canberra. There's thousands of people scrutinising it.
I think you're right, but I don't think they're the sort of gotcha moments that politicians get worried about. And it's those gotcha moments that mean that politicians will just become completely bland. They'll say nothing. You know, I think Donald Trump, funnily enough, is a good example of this. You can contradict yourself as long as you explain why and have a reason why. People are human. They get that, you know.
Not sure any of us want to invoke Donald Trump as an example of anything. We'll see what happens there.
Sam, can I ask you for your view, if we are missing this vital ingredient in public life, what would be your opinion of a federal ICAC, and do you think that would serve to restore trust because it's going to ensure transparency and accountability?
Look, I'm a huge fan of the federal ICAC idea. I think both parties have got this completely wrong on this one. I think they're running for the covers needlessly.
You've got this absurd paradox that Turnbull from the banking background says we need a royal commission into the unions, and you've got Shorten from a union background saying we need a royal commission into banks. Sure. But neither of them thinks you need a royal commission into their mates,
exactly.
Only the other guy's mates.
Exactly. And you know,
we can see that for what it is.
I was brought in as an expert witness by the New South Wales ICAC over the Nathan Tinkler coal terminal deal. And I was petrified going into this because, you know, the view as an advisor is, oh, you're going to get gotten.
It's like the Star Chamber.
And that's right. Mm. They were eminently professional, you know, eminently reasonable. They just wanted to know exactly what happened and what went on. And then it was all over and done with, you know.
Well, it's setting up the rules of engagement and how they operate. And as long as you get those rules of engagement right, well, then it should flow from there, shouldn't it?
There is a marginal cost question here, right? There is a marginal cost. You know, the Julian Assange view of the world, that everyone should have access to everyone else's secrets and things, you know, that's a problem. You know, that's a problem. And as the openness and transparency sort of intensifies, the relative utility of these things does fall away. But certainly, I think, you know, federal parliament and you know, this $30 billion defence contract.
Government departments.
That's right. You need some sort of a look, some sort of an independent watchdog looking over these massive amounts of money going out
but
the door.
It's not just data, it's the questioning. It's what comes out in skillful questioning. Mm. That's what we need. Mm.
That's right.
And we want to be subjected to the John Fain Star Chamber. So every government contract should pass through this office, be subjected to 15 minutes of hard questioning, and then you can...
I can never really understand why governments...
Fran, hold that thought for a second. I've just got an idea for you, Sarah. I mean, I do think that maybe we could set up here at the ABC a little unit that vets government deals. And we can say, look, instead of waiting a few years for this all to fall apart and we do a Four Corners on it, just bring it to us first and just run it past us and we'll tell you whether it meets with approval or not.
We give very good value for money. I think John and I can both demonstrate that in the hours that we work for the sums that we're paid. We can do it. Good value for the taxpayer too.
No good looking to me about it, Sarah.
I think we'll have lots of takers. John, what do you reckon?
You're on. Sorry, Fran, I interrupted your flight.
No, I've forgotten what the question was.
Can I just ask Sam a question about the trust deficit? What's changed? Do you think that the deficit is widening?
Oh, it's definitely getting worse. I mean, it's interesting. The best data that we've got on this, there's two really good data sets we've got. One shows that we've consistently had a problem. Once in 1969 did we actually get a majority of Australians trusting the incoming government. That was Gorton's government. Now, I don't know for the life of me what they did that, you know, registered a 51% score there, but that was the only time on record. John Howard in 96 got 49%. That was the next highest. So you could make a very good argument to say that, no, we never trust politicians. But that number is just dropping off further and further and further. The last bit of data I saw on this saw that 3% of Australians, 3% have a strong amount of trust in the federal government to do, you know, to act in the best interest of society.
Well, this raises the question, does the community demand a higher standard of elected officials than they expect of themselves?
Oh, possibly. I mean, you know, I think all the fuss about politicians' entitlements and travel, I think, is so overblown. And frankly, no one in corporate Australia would ever, you know, agree to those same things. You know, state ministers flying around in an economy that are meant to administer, you know, multi-billion dollar apartments. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous. I think you can have real debates.
Yeah, but the flip side is we don't want someone taking a helicopter from Melbourne to Geelong.
Exactly. And that's
for a party fundraiser.
It's for everyone, right?
At taxpayers' expense. Mm.
But is that trust really about abuse of power, or more related to the questions of, are you there for us or for you? Are you there just to pursue power for its own sake for you, or are you there for us? Because when I think about trust, it's more to do with that than choppers and corruption.
Sure. Look, I think you're right. And I think people like John Howard, who did manage to carve out this long-term view, a long-term trust and bond with the electorate, there was a view about him that he was there, you know, for them, for Australians.
Well, there was nothing flashy John Howard wasn't living the high life. He was going around, going for his walk in the morning in his daggy tracksuit, and he looked like he was serving the public rather than lining his pocket, looking after his mates or whatever else it is that the parties tend to do. But I do think we've got a bit of a problem. I think we've got a disease, and as much as anything, it's with the people who are prepared to put up with the internal nonsense in our parties. Their gene pool now is so narrow. There are more members of football clubs than either of our major political parties. Even the least successful football clubs have more members. The gene pool of people is narrowed. The number of people who are prepared to put up with all you have to put up with to become someone of any particular clout within a political party. I mean, a lot of decent people just give up along the way.
Well, surely. It's also the gene pool of people wanting to enter Parliament and how narrow that has become.
That's where you select it from. And, you're seeing a lot more independents, and you'll continue to see those. And people, whether it's a Xenophon or a Tony Windsor or an Andrew Wilkie, you'll see more and more people, don't you think, who say, look, I'm actually the antidote to that. And if you've got enough of a profile and you've got enough credibility and you're consistent enough, you'll get more of them.
So how does that go with Tony Windsor and Barnaby Joyce? Do people go for the independent, or do they
I'd love to see the establishment? I'd love to see the independent get up in that race.
I have to say, no, I couldn't agree with that.
And Barnaby is exactly the sort of politician we say we want more of, politicians who are authentic, who are quirky, who
Barnaby
do speak their mind.
Barnaby identifies with his electorate. He's the one that people are immediately going to know. Barnaby's going to be out there fighting for you know, our local hospital or our school or whatever it happens to be.
And we forgive him any hyperbole. This is the thing that's fantastic about Barnaby Joyce, that because of his shtick, he gets away with sometimes talking complete nonsense.
Well, could you imagine anyone but Barnaby? What were the names of those
dogs?
Pistol and Boo.
I mean, you know, nobody could have got away with that.
But go back to more serious questions, like the debate around the carbon tax that did descend into a free for all with where knowledge was dispensed with. Mm. The things he said about the carbon tax were the talk about hyperbole and over the top. But there was no punishment for Joyce, no reproach for Joyce for talking about it in those terms. Why is that?
Well, I suspect it was because he was so close to Tony Abbott. That's what I suspect.
I don't know.
But just talking about the independents for a minute, I would hate to see independents getting into our national parliament who haven't really got something to offer.
But don't you think your Ricky Muirs and Jackie Lambies and Glenn Lazaruses have actually scrubbed up? They've sincerely addressed their own admitted deficiencies. They've been on a steep learning curve. They've spoken passionately. They've responded to the electorate, and they've done everything you could ask an independent senator to do. You don't think so?
I think the media has portrayed them as that, John. I do, yes.
Well, I was as scathing as anyone of Ricky Muir when he got elected, and then he turned out to be someone who studied and worked out.
I probably had Jackie Lambie in mind when I was thinking. Actually,
you don't think they're meeting their electorate's needs?
I don't see how they could be. No, I think that they grandstand.
Sam, look, I agree with you. I think you're right. They grandstand, but I mean, for God's sakes, every politician grandstands. I mean, come on. Look, 25%
not
of the country.
Not to that extent, though.
No, but 25% of the country voted for a minor party of one shade or another. That's a big number that we need to take account of. Now, look, should Ricky Muir have been the one that sort of won that lottery? I don't know. Frankly, I think having a few more of these guys in there that do have that completely honest, open, you know, connection with the community, I'm not opposed to that. And I say that as a registered party member. You know, I'm a member of the Labor Party.
And we've got a blacksmith in Parliament instead of it all being trade union officials, business people, bankers and lawyers.
No, I'd love if they were all Labor Party people, but they're not.
John Madigan, I think, is someone he really cares about individuals. He cares about issues. I don't think he is someone that is chasing the media just to get his face on television or to get a few lines in a newspaper.
I don't think you could accuse Ricky Muir of chasing lines to get his face on television. I think he's actually quite a considered bloke.
Senator Xenophon has been accused of exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Anyway, we shouldn't be into personalities, and I don't like. I'm a party person, so I'm really, as you are, Sam, but I'm wanting to see our major political parties really shape up and really get their act together.
Isn't that part of the problem that, that makes Sam's book so interesting, that, that that is our problem, that we don't trust the parties? It's not just the individuals, but we've come to distrust the entire party. We've come to distrust the way the Labour Party operates. We've come to distrust the way the Liberal Party operates. We've come to distrust the way factions work within the Labour Party. And so these individuals appear to be free of all of those constraints and perhaps freer to pursue changes in society on our behalf.
Yeah, it's something like about 1 or less than 1% of Australians trust political parties. I think you're down to sort of paid staff and blood relatives of the politicians when
and not all of them.
Well, I think we can probably agree that there is enormous room for improvement.
Sure.
Well, and it's how you go about that in a democratic way.
Congratulations to you both for contributing to a national debate that has some urgency attached to it now because of the looming federal contest that Malcolm Turnbull has promised after the budget is out of the way. Sam Crosby is Executive Director of the McKell Institute. He was a former ministerial advisor in New South Wales in state politics and also briefly Kevin Rudd. The Trust Deficit is the book that he's written, published by Melbourne Uni Press. And it's a big day for the Melbourne Uni Press because The Killing Season Uncut is Sarah Ferguson's latest offering based on the television series. But this gives you the full version. It gives you all the information that is left out by the necessity of editing a television program to fit into its time slot. So it gives you the full behind-the-scenes story as well as some of her observations of the players as she went about conducting the interviews that became the hit TV series. The Killing Season Uncut, with Patricia Drum, Sarah Ferguson's book, and Fran Bailey, former minister in the Howard government, has been my co-host for a most interesting discussion. Text message, anyone who trusts any politician is deluding him or herself and is a damn fool, says text messenger 464. Sam Crosby, Sarah Ferguson, Fran Bailey, thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.